So last time we've calculated one of the critical exponents in mean field theory. So we saw that the order parameter, so magnetization in the case of the Ising model, behaves near the transition temperature as this kind of universal power law, right? Where T is the reduced temperature, T minus Tc divided by Tc, and then beta is equal to 1/2, okay? And so as I said, this kind of universal non-analytic behavior of physical observables near near a continuous phase transition is a very general and universal feature. Okay, so let me start today by calculating a few more critical exponents in mean field theory. Okay, so let me now add this magnetic field to the Ising model, which couples to our variables. So minus 1/2 sum over I and j, j I j, sigma I, sigma j, minus b sum over I, sigma I, right? If I now again perform all the same manipulations with this Hamiltonian, right, doing mean field theory, then the mean field Hamiltonian, so mean field Hamiltonian with this magnetic field added is going to have the following form. So I'll have minus mj plus b sum over I sigma I plus 1/2 n j m squared, okay? So you can see here that so this combination m times j, right, the order parameter times the this constant j that characterizes the strength of the interaction between the spins, so this couples to the spins as in the same way as an external magnetic field, okay? And so for this reason, this is often called molecular field, so B sub M. Molecular field. So the physical meaning of this is basically an effective field that acts on this on a given spin due to its interaction with other spins in the lattice, right? But anyway, so so now I can again do the same calculation of the free energy with this external field included. So I'm gonna get F equals nj m squared over 2 and then minus nt log of twice hyperbolic cosine, and then here instead of just mj we'll have mj plus b divided by t, right? So if I minimize this, I'll get almost the same equation for m as last time, except again, so it's going to be hyperbolic tangent of mj plus b divided by t, okay? And so what I want to calculate now using this equation is so something that's called susceptibility. I will call this chi. And so susceptibility measures how easy it is to change M by an applied external field. Okay, so I'll define this as derivative dm dB. Okay, so again, that measures just how much, by how much M is going to change if an external field, if an external field is applied, right? And let me calculate this for simplicity for T, which is greater than the critical temperature, okay? So when T is greater than the critical temperature, in the absence of the field, M is equal to zero, right? In this case, M is equal to zero when B is equal to zero. So therefore, if I apply a small B, then I expect that magnetization that will appear in response to this B is going to be proportional to B, okay? Since at B equals zero, it should be equal to zero, right? So then that small B, we expect that M is proportional to B with some coefficient which I want to find. So that coefficient is precisely the susceptibility, right? So if B is small, then M is going to be small. So then I can expand again the this hyperbolic tangent, right, to leading quarter in the argument. And so as we discussed, the tangent of x is approximately x for small x, right? So then I get m is approximately equal to mj plus b divided by t, right? Or, so if I use the fact again that j is equal to tc, or tc is equal to j, then I get m 1 minus tc divided by t is equal to b, and therefore my susceptibility chi is just equal to, this is b over t, of course, right? And then chi is just equal to 1 over t, 1 minus tc divided by t, or this is just 1 divided by t minus tc, right? So if I did the same calculation for t less than tc, I'm not going to do this explicitly, it's a simple calculation, then you would find, so for t greater than tc, you would find that chi behaves in a very similar way. It's equal to 1 divided by 2. For t less than tc, I meant tc minus t. So pretty much the same functional form, except there is a coefficient of 1/2 in front, okay? So what this means is that susceptibility diverges at tc on both sides, right? So this is chi, this is t, let's say this is tc, 0 tc, susceptibility diverges as 1 over t minus tc, or tc minus t, right? And so I can write this in the same form then, that chi near the transition behaves as absolute value of the reduced temperature, right, 2⁻⁻¹, or more generally, it's going to be t to minus gamma, okay? So gamma is another critical exponent. This is the susceptibility critical exponent. So just as in the case of the magnetization, this specific value of the critical exponent that it's equal to one, that's not really correct. Okay, that's not really observed almost at any real phase transition, right? So this is an artifact of the mean field theory, but this general behavior of the susceptibility that it diverges as some power law of the reduced temperature at the transition, that fact is captured correctly by the mean field theory, okay? So, you know, what is the physical meaning of susceptibility diverging? Well, especially, it's easy to understand, especially if you're coming from above TC, right? So as you're coming closer and closer to TC, the system, wants to magnetize spontaneously, right? So below TC, it magnetizes even in the absence of any external field. Therefore, as you come down towards TC, it becomes easier and easier to magnetize the system by applying an external field, okay? And right at TC, the susceptibility for the response of the system to external field becomes infinite because it can magnetize even by itself below TC. Now, if you are going in the opposite direction, the meaning of susceptibility would be how easy it is to actually reverse magnetization, let's say, from the up state to the down state, right? And it becomes infinitely easy as the system loses its long range, loses its order, okay? Okay, so let me just quickly calculate a couple of more exponents. So now let me do the following. Let me take this equation exactly at t equals tc, right? So exactly at t equals tc, susceptibility is infinite, right? And what I want to find is how the system responds to external field exactly at tc, right? It clearly cannot be just proportional to B anymore because the corresponding coefficient is infinite, right? To see what happens, then I have to expand the tangent to higher order in the argument. So the next order term is going to be x proportional to x cubed. So it's x minus x cubed divided by 3, right? And so if I expand the argument, I will get m is equal to mj plus b, approximately equal to mj plus b divided by t minus 1/3 mj plus b divided by t cubed, right? And so now, if I solve this equation, and if I substitute t equals tc equals j in here, then what I will get, let me skip the algebra, it's very simple. What I will get is that m is proportional to b divided by tc to the power 1/3, okay? Which I can write in the following way as m going as what I will call reduced magnetic field. So this is dimensionless field, right? Defined as actual field divided by TC. Reduced field to the power 1 over delta. And so delta is yet another critical exponent, the field critical exponent. And so in mean field theory, it's equal to 3.
Okay. Is it just by convention you're taking this as 3, not 1/3 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it's 1 over delta is just a convention. Yeah, to be honest, I forgot why it's convenient to define it as 1 over delta. I'll recall by next time. But it's convenient to define it as 1 over delta instead of delta. Okay. And finally, let me calculate just one more important critical exponent. Let me calculate what happens to the specific heat at the transition. Okay, so in fact, measurement of specific heat is one of very important experimental tools to detect a phase transition. Okay, so what is specific heat? Specific heat is what's called a thermodynamic response function. So it basically measures how easy how the system responds to external heat flow. Yeah.
Right. So I understand what you did, the expansion here, right?
You're
TC, but it's not TC.
Right.
Why are you allowed to make an expansion of the hyperbolic tangent there if just only P is small? I mean, a priori, I don't know if M is proportional to B, right?
Right, right.
So why can I do this?
Well, so right. So I guess one reasoning you can use is that if I will assume that M is going to be small, right, and if I don't get a contradiction after that, then it means that this assumption is correct, right? So in this case, indeed, I get M proportional to B to the 1/3, right? So it's not, in fact, as small as it would be away from the transition, right? So the response is stronger. B to the 1/3, when B is small, is much larger than B. So the response is indeed stronger than away from the transition, but it's still controlled in the sense that it's still small. But another reason is that at the transition point, M, in the absence of the field, is still small, right? Still zero, I mean. Right, so then you will still expect that if a small field is applied, then it will still be something that's small.
The thing that somehow confuses me is that here I see that the susceptibility is divergent and it's independent of the magnetic field.
Uh-huh.
But in here I see that the susceptibility is proportional, but not proportional, but it has to depend on your magnetic.
Well, yes. Yeah, so here, you know, so the fact that susceptibility is divergent. What does this mean? This simply means that the assumption that M is an analytic function of B is breaking down, right? So I'm assuming that if I assume that M is an analytic function of B, then it means that I can expand it in Taylor series, right? So I know that the zeroth order term is zero, and then the first order term is precisely chi times B, right? But the fact that, so that the first derivative of M with respect to B diverges, that just means that this assumption that M is an analytic function breaks down at the transition point. And in fact, what we find is that M is not an analytic function, right? It behaves as B to the 1/3. It cannot be expanded in Taylor series. So that's really what it means, that this coefficient diverges. Okay, so let's calculate the specific heat now. So specific heat, as I said, this is a one of what's called thermodynamic response functions. And so this particular one measures how the system responds to the heat, right? To externally applied heat flow, how its temperature raises in response to applied heat flow, okay? So the way it's defined is CV is defined as T times the derivative of entropy with respect to temperature at constant volume, right? So, you know, TdS is nothing but the heat differential, right? So this is dQ dT, basically. Strictly speaking, this measures, how much heat will be necessary to raise the temperature of the system by a small amount, right? And so it turns out that at any continuous phase transition, specific heat has a very distinct feature. And so, you know, measurement of specific heat can be used, for example, to detect a phase transition, even when, even if you don't know what the order parameter for the transition is. Okay? In many cases, you know, figuring out what exactly is the order parameter can be complicated, but the measuring specific heat can still be used to detect at least the fact that there is a phase transition. Okay, so let's see how that behaves, right? So entropy, I can calculate as minus derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature at constant V, right? So therefore, CV is going to be equal to minus T, second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature. And let me actually define it as a specific heat per site. Okay, so I'll divide by the number of sites, so I don't have to carry this n around, right? So then I can just write this as minus T, second derivative of free energy per site, small f, dT squared, right? And so let me use the expansion of f, which is in powers of m, right, which we did last time, using again the fact that m is small near the transition. So f is, so let me just use the result from the previous lecture. What we found is that it has a following form, Tc over 2, 1 minus Tc divided by T squared. So again, the most important thing here is this coefficient of the m squared term, which changes sign at the transition from positive above Tc to negative below Tc. And then, so there is the m to the fourth term, which has a positive coefficient, T cubed m to the fourth, right? So I want to, what I want is f just purely as a function of t, right? And so let me just use then the t dependence of m that we have found also in the previous lecture by minimizing this f, right? So what we found was that m was approximately equal to 3 square root of 1 minus t divided by tc. And I think, so in the previous lecture, I had probably something like t over tc, or tc over t in front here. So I'm assuming that tc is where t is very close to tc. So I can just set t to tc here. Here I cannot, of course, set t to tc, because then it will just make it zero identically, right? So so what I really had is 3, I don't remember, is it t over tc or tc over t? T over tc. Yeah. So that's still correct. But I had t over tc in front, so let me just use the fact that t is very close to tc, so I'll just replace that constant here by 1. Minus t over tc. And I do the same thing here. Well, so this tc stays, but here I can replace this t cubed by tc cubed, right? And so if I plug this m into here, again, it's a very simple algebra, I'm going to get the following result, that f near tc is going to be equal to minus 3 divided by 4 tc, and then t minus tc squared, right? So, you know, the meaning of this, and so this, of course, holds when T is less than TC, right? Because that M is non-zero only when T is less than TC, right? When T is greater than TC, M is zero, and therefore F is also zero. Well, it's zero compared to, you know, whatever is a normal state F, which we have neglected here.
Mm-hmm. Looked at the magnetization, we defined the critical temperature as the temperature where I see that I have magnetization or non-magnetization when I go to,
right.
To T0. So why should we expect that that critical temperature defined in terms of this should be the same critical temperature for example, any divergence of your specific heat?
Well, I mean, no, we don't. I mean, we just find that that's the case, right?
So it is possible that I have, for example, that my magnetization diverges at some critical temperature, but my specific heat diverges at others.
Not for simple phase transitions like this, where we have an order parameter that continuously vanishes. Okay. So in that case, all of those singularities are always at the same point. So, you know, there are transitions which we will talk about where a simple order parameter like this doesn't exist. And then, so the behavior of the specific heat may be more complicated. There is a feature like a peak, but it's not necessarily exactly at the transition, but in such cases when there is an order parameter, then all of those singularities occur at the same point. Because, you know, basically, just 1 second, because, you know, so all of those things can be thought of as being a consequence of the fact that F has a singular behavior as a function of temperature, because, you know, all of those things are basically derivatives of F with respect to something.
So in a more general, like, case, I can have, I mean, for me to characterize whether there is a phase transition or not, I need that at least one of those quantities that I can calculate as a non-analytic behavior.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are we assuming that B is really small because we're setting J to equal TC? I mean, J shouldn't be TC. It should be.
No, so, you know, the transition where M, you know, where M disappears exactly at TC, that only happens when B is equal to zero, right?
So
because in the presence of B, it's always finite, so then the. What do you mean by the transition is not really well defined. Yeah, so in this sense, we are assuming that B is small, right? I mean, another way of saying is that, you know, everywhere when T is not equal to TC, I'm assuming that M is an analytic function of B, and I'm expanding this to first order. And a coefficient behaves, coefficient is independent of B, it only depends on temperature, and it diverges at TC. But yeah, but it's an important point that the transition actually happens only at B equals zero, because, you know, so if you think of transition as breaking of symmetry, spontaneous breaking of symmetry, then, you know, in the presence of B, there is really no symmetry to break, right? Because presence of B already violates the symmetry. Okay, so this is the behavior of the specific heat. So the fact that you know, it's negative below TC. So this is basically gain in the free energy when the system magnetizes, right? Gain compared to zero, which would happen when the system is not magnetized. Right. Okay. So let's just take its second derivative now. Erase this. Okay, so if I calculate the second derivative of this, which is really easy, I get, so at CV is minus T d to F dt squared at constant V. So this is just equal to 3/2 of T divided by Tc, okay? So this is the case for T less than Tc. And then Cv is equal to 0 for T greater than Tc. It's not really 0, of course. It's whatever is the specific heat that's coming from the parts of the description that we've neglected here. We've only basically retained the part of the free energy that depends on the order parameter. Okay? There are other parts to the free energy that don't depend on the order parameter, so they will give you some other CV, right? But so that part we are ignoring. We are assuming that nothing happens to that part of the free energy at the transition. It's just a smooth analytic function. Yeah. Well, no, no. So in that Hamiltonian, everything was included. But, you know, presumably that Hamiltonian is also an approximation to something that's something more complicated. You know, here, let's say if you think about a solid, right, a magnet, so this only includes the spins, right? But there may be other degrees of freedom, like just electrons moving around the lattice. So we are not including that part.
But that part wasn't in the Hamiltonian as well, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah. So as far as the Ising model Hamiltonian is concerned, everything is here. Yeah. So then the specific heat behaves as a function of T in the following way. So it's linear for T less than Tc. Well, of course, this is true only for T sufficiently close to Tc because we have expanded the free energy, right? But so sufficiently close to Tc, this is linear, and then it just jumps at Tc to zero, and the magnitude of the jump, as you can see, is just again just a number, 3/2. Okay, so delta Cv T is equal to Tc. Is equal to 3/2. Okay. So this kind of so you see that okay so the specific heat does have a feature at the transition. The character of this feature, this kind of jump, right? This is also an artifact of mean field theory. I mean the only real transition where something like this is observed is actually a superconducting to normal transition in metals for reasons that we may talk about later. Okay, so it turns out that that particular transition is very well described by mean field theory. But in most other transitions, instead of this kind of jump, what's observed is a divergence. Okay, so in fact, usually it's not a jump, but a peak, which may have a form that's kind of resembles that jump, but it's actually a peak. Okay. So if your measurement if the precision of your of whatever is your measurement instrument is very small and that peak is very narrow, then you may not actually see that that's a peak, right? It would look to you like this is a jump, but if you go sufficiently close to the transition, you always see that it actually diverges, and so I can write this as T reduced temperature absolute value to minus alpha, where alpha is the specific heat critical exponent. So mean field theory predicts that alpha is equal to zero, right? Because we simply get a constant jump instead of divergence. So in mean field theory, alpha is equal to zero, but that's not really the case. Okay. Okay, so we've calculated this number of critical exponents, right? So the order parameter critical exponent, the susceptibility critical exponent, gamma, the field critical exponent delta, specific heat critical exponent alpha. There are other critical exponents which I will introduce later. So this set of critical exponents completely characterizes a continuous phase transition. Okay. So this or at least it completely characterizes the universal properties of a continuous phase transition. Fully characterizes of a I mean, what I mean by universal. So, you know, if you, for example, take TC, right, the value of TC, that is also a property of a phase transition, right? But that is not universal. So the way we see it here is that TC is proportional to, TC is just equal to J, right? And J is something that characterizes the specific microscopic Hamiltonian that we started from, in this case, the Ising model, right? So that is not universal. That depends on details of the specific system. However, those critical exponents, so in mean field theory, they are simple numbers, right? So they are not dependent on specific, you know, on details of a specific system. Okay.
It's not entirely obvious to me that you can characterize all the universal properties with just four exponents.
So it turns out that those this is maybe something that you will cover in your tutorials, but I'm not going to talk about that at least now. I might mention this later, but in fact, those critical exponents are not independent. So there are exact relations between the critical exponents, and in fact, you only need to know two of them always. To find the rest. Okay. So in fact, this four is even an overkill. So you only need to know two. Okay.
What I sort of meant was like, could we have had another, say, theta or phi as a critical exponent as well in addition?
Sure. So this is not an exhaustive list, right? In fact, I will introduce other critical exponents later.
In this setup, these are the four that we tell you
about. I'm just saying that there are more critical exponents in principle than those four. But so this set of critical exponents, not necessarily this specific set, but the full set of critical exponents in principle characterizes fully the transition. Okay.
But basically, you can get all of those.
Yeah, you can get all of those from just any two of these. Okay. Yeah.
So in general, for every observable quantity that you have, you can find a critical exponent.
If that observable quantity cares about the transition,
right.
If that has a behavior that's non-analytic at the transition, then yes, yeah. Okay, so so a very important idea in this whole field. Is due to Landau, who generalized this mean field theory, and that generalization is based on the following observation. So that as long as we are talking about continuous phase transitions, right, where we can expand, if we are sufficiently close to the critical temperature, we can expand the free energy and powers of the order parameter. We don't really need to go through this derivation of the mean field theory starting from any particular microscopic Hamiltonian, right? We can actually write down the form of the dependence of the free energy on the order parameter near transition based on very general considerations, okay? So in particular, in this case, what do we need to know? Well, of course, obviously, we need to know that there is an order parameter, right, which has the meaning of the average magnetization on a given site, right? And we need to know the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, right? So we need to know that the Hamiltonian must be symmetric with respect to this transformation of all sigma i's going to minus sigma I. And as a consequence, the free energy has to be an even function of M, right? So the free energy F of M has to be an even function, right? Then, I mean, that completely restricts the, well, that plus, of course, the assumption that F is an analytic function of M, right? That completely restricts the form of this expansion of the free energy, right? So that immediately tells me that near TC, F has to behave in the following way at some coefficient R times M squared, right, plus some other coefficient U times M to the fourth, right? Now, so the coefficient U always has to be positive, otherwise my system would be unstable, right? If U would be negative, then the free energy would be minimized for infinitely large magnetization, right? That's obviously unphysical. So just from basic physical considerations, U has to be positive. And then, so if you just postulate that R changes sign at TC, right? And therefore, you know, the first approximation is just proportional to T minus TC, right? That's all we need to know to calculate those mean field critical exponents, okay? We don't actually need to know any other details of the of this problem, okay? So, yeah.
Is it possible, I mean, in this case, of course, it's not, but I mean, how do you know that U is not zero?
Well, that's a good point. So, in principle, well, let's say U is not zero, but, you know, suppose U happens to be negative, right? Then I could still save this situation by expanding further, right? So, for example, U is negative. I have minus U, well, okay, so plus U is negative. So the free energy as written in this form doesn't make any sense, right? But I could save this by expanding to sixth order, right? And if V is still positive, then, you know, as far as the stability is concerned, it's still fine, right? But in this case, you know, this kind of free energy would actually not describe a second order transition. This would describe a first order transition where the order parameter jumps at TC. Okay? So if we, for continuous transitions, U really has to be positive. So this in fact, you know, may be one of your homework assignments or tutorials, just showing that you know, this kind of more general form of the free energy can also describe first order transitions if U is taken to be negative. Okay. And so this, you know, this basically, this idea shows you why critical exponents are universal, right? Because here, pretty much no specific information about the about microscopics of the system enters, right? We just know that there is an order parameter. We know the symmetry of the order parameter. We know that the free energy has to be an even function of that, right? Because order parameter can be either positive or negative, which expresses the fact that magnetization can be either up or down, right? And just on that basis, we can calculate the values of the critical exponents. Yeah. Sorry? Well, there can be a constant term, but we don't really care about it, right? I mean, if you minimize with respect to M, that's not going to enter. Okay. So, you know, so basically then what it means is that this kind of idea, right, that we can characterize a continuous transition by a constant order parameter. You simply write down the expansion of the free energy in powers of the order parameter, minimize it, and we find the set of critical exponents. This would suggest that, in fact, all continuous transitions are, in this sense, the same. That they are characterized by the same critical exponents, right? And that's, of course, not true. So in reality, there are different types of continuous transitions, right? And so transitions that have the same set of critical exponents are said to belong to the same universality class, okay? So transitions characterized by the same set of critical exponents belong to the same universality class. So mean field theory would tell you that there is in fact just one universality class, and all continuous transitions belong to this mean field universality class. So that's, in reality, that's not the case. There are many different universality classes, okay? And so, in fact, those particular mean field values of the critical exponents are almost never observed. So there is the only transition I know that's that's to a very good precision has mean field critical exponents are, as I mentioned, the superconductor to normal transition in metals, okay? And there are very good reasons for that, which I'll mention later, okay? So in fact, this mean field theory story is just a little bit too good to be true. So critical exponents are not completely universal. So experimentally, what you find is that they depend on several things. So critical exponents depend. So one very important parameter on which critical exponents always depend is dimensionality of space. So which means that, you know, even if you look at the same transition, let's say a ferromagnet to paramagnet transition, in a bulk material, bulk three-dimensional sample, and then in the same sample, which is in the form of a very thin, almost two-dimensional film, right, then the critical exponents will be very different in those two cases, okay? So dimensionality of space, they depend on the nature of the order parameter. So in particular, for example, here, in the case of the Ising model, order parameter is a scalar, right? So it has just one component, right? Generally, critical exponents will depend on, so let's say if you're talking about magnetization, right? If you allow this magnetization to deviate from one axis, right? And actually rotate freely in space, right? Then again, the critical exponents will be different, right? So nature of the order parameter, such as number of components, right? So scalar order parameter versus a vector order parameter. Number of components and also the symmetry, right? Symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so there are these are kind of few things, right? And these things are very general. Largely independent of microscopic details, right? But so even that kind of dependence is still this is not captured by mean field theory. Okay, so in mean field theory, all critical exponents have just one value that's independent of anything. Okay, so we want to do better than mean field theory. Yeah.
So your order parameter here is independent of position, right? It's just a global
order. Right. Well, I mean, so what you know, so what exactly do you mean by a local order parameter?
Let's say your magnetization depends on the
right. So you know, for example, suppose I have instead of ferromagnet an anti-ferromagnet, right? Where magnetization let's say staggers from site to site, right? But I can still define an order parameter that's completely uniform if I just rotate magnetization, you know, just change direction of the quantization axis on every other site. So it's always possible to define a uniform order parameter, and that just expresses the fact that what happens at the transition is some kind of order, right? So order means that there are long range correlations. So you can always find a variable which is then uniform.
I'm not sure what we mean by local order parameter. Isn't order something you can only judge over a global?
Well, yeah. Although you are right in the sense that you know, the reason that mean field theory fails is precisely the fact that mean field theory does not allow by construction the order parameter to fluctuate. So we are assuming that the order parameter is just a number in this case, right? But and so as we will see, in fact, the way to cure mean field theory is to allow the order parameter to be position dependent and to fluctuate. There is still an average of that fluctuating order parameter that's non-zero, right? And so then the meaning of M is really the average. Okay.
But then do we not call that average the order parameter?
Well, yeah. Okay. You will see what I mean exactly. Okay. So basically, just as I just said, the reason that mean field theory fails is that it treats this average magnetization as being just completely independent of I and always constant, right? When in fact, it can fluctuate. Basically, what we have to do is allow M to fluctuate. Okay. Reason mean field theory fails, so it treats order parameter as a constant, when in fact what we want to do is treat it as a thermodynamic variable that can be spatially dependent and which can fluctuate, okay, but which can have below TC a non-zero average, okay? So it's constant, so we want to treat M as a thermodynamic variable which can fluctuate. Okay. And so the there are several ways to kind of introduce that fluctuating order parameter. I'll choose the more formal and less hand waving way, which I think is better. Okay. So this is based on a just purely mathematical trick, which is called the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. Okay, so this transformation is basically nothing but the following very simple identity. So suppose I have a real variable phi, which can range from minus to plus infinity, right? Then, so the following simple identity is true, that 1 over root 2 pi integral from minus infinity to plus infinity over phi of e to minus 1/2 a phi squared plus b phi. So assuming that that integral converges, right, which means that a has to be non-negative, right, while b can be anything, can have any sign. So this is equal to 1 over square root of a e to b squared divided by 2a, okay? So this integral, as you know, is called Gaussian integral, right? It's e to minus variable squared, right? And so this is a simple identity which you can easily check in Mathematica, for example, or just do it by hand, okay? So what I want to use is just a multidimensional generalization of this identity. So Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation is based on a multidimensional generalization of this identity, okay? A multidimensional generalization looks like this. So the dimension here will be the size of my lattice, right? The number of sites in the lattice. And so the following is true then, that 1 over 2 pi to the power n over 2, right? So that's the this 1 over root pi taken to the power n, right? Integral from minus infinity to infinity d phi 1 d phi 2 d phi n. So now I introduce this real variable for every site of the lattice. And I have e to minus 1/2, so that a times phi squared I will just generalize to any quadratic form, right? To a quadratic form, and I will write it in the following way as phi I, some matrix A, I j, phi j, and I'm using here Einstein summation convention, right? So the repeated indices are summed over. Plus, let me use the same notation as my notes. So instead of B, I have gammas for some reason. So gamma I phi I. And again, here the indices are summed over, right? So this integral converges as long as this matrix is positive definite, meaning that its determinant is non-negative, right? And so this integral, I'm not going to prove that. That's simple, and you'll probably do this in your tutorials. So this integral is equal to 1 over square root of the determinant of A, right? So that's the generalization of 1 over root A. And then e to 1/2 gamma I a I j inverse. So that's the I jth element of the inverse of matrix A, right? Which exists again because the determinant is non-negative. Gamma j. Okay. Again, this holds as long as A is real symmetric positive definite matrix. Okay. I mean, basically, the way you prove this is you can simply diagonalize the matrix A, right, and rewrite this as basically a bunch of eigenvalues of A times the same phi I squared. So you will simply have a bunch of one-dimensional Gaussian integrals for each eigenvalue of A, and since the A is real symmetric positive definite, all those eigenvalues are real and non-negative. And you simply have the same result there, right? So the determinant of A is going to be the product of the eigenvalues. Okay, so let's now apply this identity to the partition function of the Ising model. Okay, so let me again take my Ising model Hamiltonian. J I j sigma I sigma j. So the partition function is going to be sum over all configurations of sigma e to 1 over 2t sum over I and j, j I j sigma I sigma j, right? And I'm going to apply this identity, but backwards, right? So what I suppose that what I have here, this is this thing, right? And I want to instead rewrite this as this multidimensional integral. Okay? And you will see why it's useful in just a second. So if I just apply this identity, right? So I'll get the following result. So I'll have, so t to n over 2, right, divided by square root of the determinant of j, where j is this n by n matrix, whose matrix elements are jij, right? So j is not the same as that constant j we had in Minfield theory. J is the n by n matrix, right, which characterizes the interactions between the spins. Then I have 1, 2 pi to the n over 2, right? And then sum over all sigma i's, and then integral. So it may look kind of messy and complicated, but it's actually really simple, as we'll see. D phi 1, d phi n, right? E to minus t over 2, right? So I have to invert the matrix jij divided by t, right? So the inverse is going to be t times jij inverse. So minus t over 2 sum over I and j inverse ij, okay? So again, these are matrix elements of the matrix j inverse, okay? Again, so this may look complicated, right? Having to invert, just one second, having to invert this n by n matrix, as you will see, we actually won't really have to do that. Yeah.
Why do you have the determinant of j in the denominator?
Because so my j is the same as a inverse here, right?
Okay.
So I have this thing is okay. Yeah. So it's the determinant of it's times the determinant of J inverse, therefore one of the determinant of J. Yeah. So I have Jij inverse. Let me write it in this way. So phi I J inverse Ij phi J, right? And then plus sum over I phi I sigma I, right? So this is that term, right? And the second term is this. And sorry, I guess let me, yeah, since I was using Einstein convention there, let me use it here as well. Let me not have the sign of sum explicitly. Okay. Sorry? Yeah.
So you're trying to motivate that we should have M as a thermodynamic variable.
Right.
So shouldn't we choose the Hamiltonian to have a magnetic field?
I mean, we can add magnetic field, sure. That's not going to be a problem. But the point of this transformation is basically, so as we will see, those fields phi will precisely have the meaning of the position-dependent magnetization, right? So you know, the difference between the fields phi and the sigmas, right, is that sigmas are discrete, right? Sigmas are the spins that can have, you know, either, that can be either plus one or minus one, while phis are real, right? And so in a sense, phis represent, this is not a precise statement, but phis represent the average values of sigma on a given site, okay? But so far, this is just a formal mathematical transformation, and it's completely exact. Yeah.
So this average value that you're talking about at a given site, it's weighted based on the proximity of the sites around it?
No. So, you know, you will see exactly what the meaning of those variables is. But, you know, so far, this is just a formal mathematical transformation. So let's just view it as such at this point, okay? Just an exact formal transformation. And let me just to rewrite this in a slightly better form, let me actually change variables in this integral. Oops. Let me change integration variables from phi I to phi I divided by t, right? You know, I just want to have this term in a form that's similar to a Boltzmann weight, right? So the t is in the denominator rather than in the numerator. I mean, but again, this is a simply formal change of variables. So then this thing transforms into a 1, so still 1 over the determinant of j, right? And then I have 1 divided by so 2 pi times t to the n over 2, right? So that comes from the change of the measure of the integration. And then I have sum over sigmas and then integral from minus infinity to infinity, d phi 1, d phi n. So e to minus 1 divided by 2t, phi I, j I, j inverse, phi j plus phi I, sigma I, right? Now, so this thing here, so it's a function of temperature in principle, right? But it's not an important function of temperature for us in the sense that this will certainly not have any singularities in at the transition, right? This is a smooth function of temperature. So this is the partition function of the Ising model, right? When I calculate the free energy and take a log of the partition function, this thing in front is just going to give me a term, an additional term in the free energy that depends smoothly and weakly on the temperature. Okay, so then you know, I can just ignore that this coefficient here. I can just set it to 1 from now on. It's far from 1, but you know, since it's not important, I'll just set it to 1. Just I don't want to carry it around. Yeah. The reason is that, you know, what we are interested in is the phase transition where things are supposed to behave singularly as a function of t. This is obviously not singular.
Also, did you forget a 1 over t?
Yeah,
yes. Yeah. So there is a 1 over t here, of course. Right? Yeah. So then we obtain the following exact up to that unimportant constant representation for the partition function of the Ising model. Right? So this is sum over sigma integral d minus infinity to infinity d phi 1 d phi n e to minus 1 over 2 t phi I j I j inverse phi j plus 1 over t phi I sigma I. Okay? So one reason this transformation is useful, right, is that so before we had a Hamiltonian where the spins on different sides interacted, right? And that was why we could not calculate the partition function, right? So here the interaction between the spins has been replaced by interaction of the spins with this field phi, okay? So of course we have not really gained anything because, you know, this is just exactly writing. Right? We have replaced a difficult problem of calculating the partition function of the Ising model with a difficult problem of calculating this multidimensional integral. Okay? But at least in this way, we can get rid of the variables phi, of the variable sigma, and rewrite the problem purely in terms of the variables phi. Okay? And that's exactly what we want to do. So again, as we will see later, phi's precisely have the meaning of the of this fluctuating order parameter. Okay. Okay. So let me let's now do that sum over sigma, right? So that it has exactly the same form as in the when we calculated the partition function of the Ising model and mean field theory, right? Because mean field theory does precisely the same thing. It decouples the interaction between spins, right, into it represents the interaction between spins basically as an interaction of the spin with some effective field that's created by other spins, right? So that's not exact, but this is exact. So if you represent the interaction between spins as an interaction of spin with some fluctuating field, that's actually correct, exactly correct, unlike mean field theory, which replaces that field by some uniform thing that doesn't fluctuate. Okay, anyway, so let's continue that calculation. So I'm gonna get, let's actually calculate directly the free energy, which is minus T log of this. So F is minus T log of Z, right? And so then F is going to be equal to.
Is this phi similar to the scalar field that you have in quantum field theory?
Yeah. So yeah. In fact, this is how you transform the Ising model into a field theory. Yeah. Yeah. You are basically going from discrete variables, sigmas from sigmas to a real field, right, that depends on I. And we will transform it later into a form that looks exactly like a relativistic quantum field theory, right? If you interpret one of the dimensions of space as time. Yeah. Let me just. Another note. Other notes here. Sorry. Let me actually calculate z, not f. Sorry about this. And let me introduce the following shorthand notation. I will call a capital D phi the product of those differentials of phi on every side, right? D phi 1, D phi 2, D phi n, right? So then I can write G in the following way as integral d phi, right, e to minus 1 over 2t phi I j I j inverse phi j, right? And then, okay, so when we calculate the sum over sigma on every side, what I get is twice hyperbolic cosine of phi I divided by t, right? Exactly as in mean field theory, right? Now let me write that in the following way. Let me put that hyperbolic cosine of phi I over t in the exponential by taking its log, right? I write this as plus sorry, there is a slight, I slightly screwed up the notation here. So I was using the Einstein convention, but actually at this point it becomes inconvenient. So let me go back to the sums. Sorry. So sum over ij, the reason it's inconvenient is that now I have this log of phi I, right? And I still have to sum over I. Sum over I log of 2 twice hyperbolic cosine of phi I divided by t. Okay? Okay, so we've gotten read completely. And it's a minus, sorry, yeah. No, it's a plus, that's right.
So what happened to the sum over the different sigma configurations?
So the sum over sigmas, right? So if I, so sum over sigma I, right, of e to 1 over t phi I sigma I, this is just equal to twice hyperbolic cosine of phi I divided by t, right?
Yeah.
And I've simply, you know, written that in the exponential by taking its log, right?
I was talking about
this is
so there are two terms in the exponential.
Right.
Oh yes.
Sorry.
Okay.
So this is so this is of course all
yes.
an argument of the exponential. Yeah. Okay. So let me call this minus the argument of the exponential, erase this thing. Oops. Let me call this functional of the field phi, which I have in the argument of the exponential. Let me call it S. S of phi. So that's going to be 1 over 2t sum over I and j phi I j I j inverse phi j and then plus minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine phi I divided by t, right? So in you know, in relativistic quantum field theory, that S has a meaning of action. Okay. And my Z is just integral over all phi's of e to minus S of phi. Okay. So again, in the quantum field theory, that would be equivalent to this would be an Euclidean time representation of a of the S matrix, basically, of the evolution operator. Okay. 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 So you basically, again, so we've transformed the problem of calculating the partition function of the Ising model into the problem of calculating this this multidimensional integral. Right. This is so far completely exact transformation, apart from, you know, neglecting some unimportant constants. Okay. So it turns out that mean field theory that we've done before, in the language of that of this representation, corresponds to doing this integral using the saddle point approximation. Okay, so you know that if I have an integral of this form, integral from minus infinity to infinity over some variable x, let's take it to be real for simplicity, of e to minus some function f of x, right? So then due to the fact that the integrand depends on x in this extremely strong manner, exponentially, to a very good approximation, we can calculate this integral in the following way. As, so suppose f has one minimum, right, at x equals 0. Then I can calculate the integral in the following way as e to minus f of 0, right? And now I'm expanding around this minimum to second order, right? Since it's a minimum, the first derivatives vanish, right? And then what I have is integral from minus infinity to infinity. Let me call deviation from 0, well, it's still x since it's 0, right? So I have integral over x of e to minus 1/2 second derivative of f taken at 0, and it's positive because what I'm expanding around is the minimum, right, times x squared, right? And that integral can be easily done because it's just a Gaussian integral, right? We've just discussed it, basically, right? And again, that, you know, this is a good approximation as long as f has this kind of form, right? So it has a minimum at x equals 0, and then, you know, it increases sufficiently quickly away from the minimum, okay? Then, you know, after, especially after you you take this to, in the exponential, right, the integrand basically decreases extremely quickly away from the minimum of f. And so the contribution of x as far away from the minimum is negligible. Okay? So it turns out, and I guess I'll show it already next time, that mean field theory precisely corresponds to evaluating this multidimensional integral in a saddle point approximation. Okay? So that kind of shows you the meaning of mean field theory a little bit better. But the real value of this representation is that this allows you to, this allows us to kind of systematically calculate corrections to mean field theory, systematically go beyond mean field theory. Okay? Okay, so let's continue tomorrow.